Hi there, I'm K-Town, and on this edition of Mysterious Radio. Let's talk about your interest in this case and where that came from.
Well, when I was a boy, we would always go to the Jersey Shore, specifically a town called Stone Harbor. But even before then, my parents actually had met down in Summers Point, New Jersey, about 200 yards from where the girls in this book, Susan Davis and Elizabeth Perry, disappeared. And whenever we would take these trips to the beach during the summertime for vacation, you know, there's several ways to get down there, but the easiest way is to go by way of the Garden State Parkway. And driving north on these trips when I was a boy, I would always look often to the woods on either side of me, fascinating as it whizzed by, sort of like being on a train, because I grew up in the suburbs and there were no woods where I grew up. So, except for summer camp. I'd look on the woods and I was always fascinated by it. And during one of these sort of daydreaming moments, I remember my mother leaning over to my father and saying, "They never found out who killed those girls, did they?" And I thought that was fascinating. And I asked my dad to explain, and they sort of told me the case that these two girls were murdered alongside the woods about a couple hundred yards in, never found out who did it. And I was about 12 when that happened. And I sort of compartmentalized that memory until about 1993, when there was an article in the Philadelphia Inquirer indicating that serial killer Ted Bundy had been in the area in 1969 and was a student during the spring semester at Temple University while living with his aunt in the Lafayette Hill section, which is a suburb of Philadelphia. The article was interviewing the journalist who had written the article was interviewing Richard Larson, who had written a book called A Deliberate Stranger, which alongside with Ann Rule's The Stranger Beside Me were the two main books, main studies of Ted Bundy at the time. And Larson was convinced that these were Ted Bundy's first murders, that is, of Susan Davis and Elizabeth Perry. I sort of, again, was compartmentalizing until I began writing in the early 2000s and decided that it would make a great short story. I published a short story in a small literary journal out in San Francisco and thereafter turned that into a full book, a fiction book called The Origins of Infamy, about the Garden State Parkway murders, told entirely from Ted Bundy's perspective, beginning when he was on death row and then flashing back to his time in Philadelphia in the spring of 69 and going to New York City. It had always been Ted Bundy's MO. I shouldn't say MO. It was confirmed that he was in Philadelphia during that time period. And the remarks that he made were twofold. In 1986, he said to a death row psychologist named Art Norman that in the spring of 69, he was really in a strange place in his life. He had been going to Temple University just as a means of getting away from Seattle or Tacoma, one of those two places. He said he would often travel to New York City, and it was there in Times Square where he developed a fascination with pornography. And while in there, it sort of manifested itself into an obsession. And he said on two separate occasions that he went down to the Jersey Shore and impliedly admitted his involvement in the murders of Susan Davis and Elizabeth Perry on the Parkway. Again, at the spot where I passed when I was a boy. So that's the long-winded version of how I first became interested in the case. And then, of course, I spent the last 10 years now writing the book, The Garden State Parkway Murders, which is the true story of how this all happened.
Now, that is interesting there. Ted Bundy. Before Ted made this admission to the psychologist, you know, he did this on two different occasions, right? While he was incarcerated.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. Did we know, or did he ever say anything about his first victims at all?
I never read anything about that. No, I mean, there's Anne Marie Burr, apparently was a 13-year-old girl that pundits had always attributed to Ted, a girl who disappeared in his Tacoma neighborhood. But I wasn't aware of that. Any real definitive first murders, the authorities had always pinned it, I guess, alleged that they began in 1974 with, I think it was Healy was her last name, who was a radio DJ and a student who was living on the University of District in Seattle when she was abducted. But I always thought it fascinating. He was always very circumspect and cagey regarding when he first began killing. But on those two different occasions, they're very similar. In 1986, again, he was talking with this Art Norman, this death row psychologist, and Dr. Norman sort of gave him free rein to talk about whatever he wanted to talk about. And he indicated that, well, he would speak in the third person. He said, oh, it was 1969, and, you know, I was just in a very strange place in my life, and it was the end of the school semester, and I wound up going to a place they call the Jersey Shore, saw a couple of girls line up on the beach. I picked them up, and it wound up being the first time that he did it. And afterward, when he left for the West Coast, it was more of an escape. And Dr. Norman sort of kept that close to him, didn't say anything about it until after Bundy was executed in 1989, because he didn't want to violate any Hippocratic oath. But the day after Bundy was executed, he notified the Atlanta County, New Jersey authorities of the disturbing similarities between the murders of Susan Davis and Elizabeth Perry, and thought that maybe he was involved in it, given, again, the very, very similar nature of the crimes. So it's just one of those interesting facets. And then in 1989, the day before he was executed, on his second to last interview of his life, Dr. Dorothy Lewis asked him, say, Ted, you can talk about whatever you want to talk about. What would you like to discuss? And he started to talk about, again, Ocean City, about how he was down there at the time. But he wanted to bring it up, he said, to distinguish between what he had said earlier. Now, there was no earlier that he had talked about it other than 1986. It was strange how he seemed to have made this leap in time from 1986 to 1989 and said, I went down to Ocean City in this beautiful seaside resort, and I met a girl down there and chased her around and attempted to abduct her, and she got away. And he said he was very frightened by that near miss, but he wanted to emphasize that he didn't kill anyone that time. But he never really admitted it in killing anyone, sort of say, I killed so-and-so. He hinted at it, but I just thought it was so strange that on those two separate occasions, in each instance where the psychologist interviewing him gave him free rein to discuss what he wanted to, he sort of pulled from the vast recesses of his disturbed mind, Ocean City. So I sort of had to wonder, to the extent that these serial killers, confabulate, they'll say something true wrapped around a lie, or they'll say a lie wrapped around the truth, and sort of it's a game to have the interviewer figure out what he's talking about, how in both instances he brought up the Ocean City murders. So that's always compelled me, and of course I discuss that in the book.
Okay. All right, let me ask you this. Let's go back, and then I want to come back and talk about those discussions with Ted on death row. Can you give us some background about the era of that time when these murders occurred? You know, what was the community like, and where the Parkway was located and such?
Okay, so the Parkway starts up in North Jersey, goes all the way down the coast to all the beach towns, goes all the way down to Cape May, which is the southernmost point of New Jersey. And back in the Ocean City was actually founded as a seaside resort for Christians. Three ministers had founded it. It had always been a Christian town where no drinking was allowed. The blue laws are still in effect down there. There's no drinking allowed. There are no bars. It's always characterized itself as a very family-oriented community. And the moniker, it's always been America's greatest family resort. They've always marketed themselves towards families. But in about the 1960s, consistent with, I guess, society generally, the counterculture movement began, and more and more, I don't want to say hippie types, but that's where they were. They were called hippie types. And if you read the old newspaper articles chronicling that era, that's what the locals called them, hippies, very disparagingly, sort of crashed into the community. And what they would do is they would stay, this being the college kids, the hippies, they would stay at one of the many boarding houses that were in Ocean City, you know, go to the beach during the day, and then they would drive over the bridge to Summers Point, a mile away. And in Summers Point, there were a lot of bars. That was really where everyone went. And in fact, they called it the Fort Lauderdale of the North. Everyone would go there. They had several bars, one of which was Tony Mart's. I don't know if you've ever seen the cult classic Eddie and the Cruisers. It was actually filmed there.
Yeah.
The musical group, the band with Robbie Robertson. They actually were the house band, Tony Mart's, in Summers Point in the summer, I think, of 64. And rumor has it that Bob Dylan actually called them and asked them to leave and join him and open on his tour. And that's how the band took off. But it had always been a very raucous crowd of people. A lot of drinking. Several of these bars were open all night. And what they would do is, again, party there all night and go into the Summers Point Diner nearby, stagger over there. And again, that's where Susan and Davis and Elizabeth Perry were last seen.
Okay. All right. So, okay. So let's talk about the night that they disappeared. Do you know about their last moments?
They were college friends at a now defunct college called Monticello College in Illinois. It was an all girls 2-year school. And they had gone, Susan and Elizabeth had left from there, driven down to the Jersey Shore. They were intended to stay for 3 days. And from thereafter, the plan was to go back to Pennsylvania. Susan was from Minnesota originally, and Elizabeth was from Minnesota, Lake Minnetonka area. And Susan was from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. So the plan was they would drive down in Susan's convertible, hang out at the beach for 3 days, sun themselves, and then go back up to Susan's parents' home in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and join her parents to go down to Duke University in Durham, North Carolina, to attend Susan's older brother's college graduation. So they went down there, they got some sun, and as they were leaving, they left at about 4:30 a.m. on May 30th, 1969, Memorial Day, which was on a Friday that year. It didn't change into a Monday holiday until, I think, 1972. So they were there, Walter Sibon, who owned the house where they were staying on 9th Street near the beach, saw them off in the morning. They took off. The next thing, this, according to witnesses, they went to the Summers Point Diner, again, where everyone would gather. There was a 24/7 line to get in there with the bars emptying out and it being the only place open at that hour of the day to eat at around 6 a.m. Sun rises at 5:29 a.m. that morning. They were there when the sun rose because one of the waitresses said that one of the girls had asked her to close the blinds. They were seen with three boys. No one saw them. They were eating with three boys, I should say. There was a dispute over the check, but not a major dispute. They left at about 6:15 or 6:30, got in their car. No one saw them leave the restaurant. They got in their car, drove around the circle, and about 3 days later, and I'm sorry, the same morning, a police officer with the state police had driven and seen the car pulled over to the side of the road. It was empty. He determined that it had been abandoned. And he called the tow truck to take it away, and he left for town for a fishing vacation. So no one really knew what happened, and he obviously didn't know because he was out of town and away from communication that Susan's parents and Elizabeth's parents knew that they didn't show up at Susan's house. So they figured something was wrong, a missing persons. Alarm was sounded, and when the trooper, whose name was Lewis Sturr, returned from his fishing vacation, he saw the APB out and realized, oh my God, that car that I towed belonged to those girls. He didn't know that anything bad had happened to them. So that's what happened.
Oh, all right. So their parents had not reported them missing prior to him towing the car.
That's correct. It wasn't until after they didn't show up that they reported him missing.
Being that this was a very popular spot, do you know if they saw homicides in that area prior to these two murders?
It just wasn't a town like that. You know, there were, again, reverting back to what the locals called quote unquote undesirables in town, with, you know, the hippies and the drifters and whatever, you know, and whatever the 60s sort of brought about. And whatever your interpretation of that was. But no, there weren't any homicides. There was in 1964, there was actually a guy named Fudgy Engelmeyer who was murdered down there. And that was sadly considered a gay bashing. That was never solved. But other than Fudgy's murder, no, there were no other murders, so to speak, of down there. It's always been, again, a very, very... you know, not that type of place that people would go to party and revel, again, unless they went to Summers Point. But people were shocked that this could happen. In fact, I've spoken with several people who were just kids back then, and they said their parents wouldn't let them go to the Summers Point Circle after that. Everyone was really put on guard because they never found out who did it. And there was always the fear that they didn't characterize it as a serial killer back then, but there was a fear that, you know, within the community that whoever did it was out there and might strike again.
Okay. All right. So let's pick it up from the point where their parents reported them missing. Then at that time or that back then, what did police do? I mean, did they jump right on the case or did they give it more time to see if they would come back, or how did that work at that time?
Once Trooper Stir returned from his vacation and recognized that the car that he had towed belonged to the girls, that's when everything was set in motion. And they began a massive search in the area, a grid search. The highway workers on hands and knees went to the area and began a search, off-duty troopers and so forth. And it wasn't about 15 minutes or so into the search when a man named Elwood Fonts, a highway worker, stumbled upon the bodies of Susan Davis and Elizabeth Perry between mile marker 31.9 and 31.8 on the northbound lanes of the parkway, right near where their car had been parked, only about 1.9 miles from the diner itself. So they were actually, according to coroner's estimates, murdered within 45 minutes of the time that they left the diner.
Oh, wow. That seems like you think maybe they picked someone up, or don't answer that yet. I'm jumping ahead myself. Okay.
It's okay.
All right. So how many days have lapsed at this time from the point that their parents were worried about them and they knew something was wrong? How many days had lapsed between that and finding the bodies?
3 days.
And what was the condition of the bodies?
Very decomposed. Some animals had obviously been at them. It was extremely hot. I don't know if you're familiar with East Coast weather. It tends to be pretty cold and temperate, and there's the very abrupt transition from it being springtime to the summer. But even so, the real hot weather doesn't begin until the end of June. And this was the end of May, and it had been in the 90s for several days. And that contributed toward the decomposition of the bodies. In fact, I interviewed a man named John Divel, who was with the Ocean City Police Department. And although they didn't have jurisdiction was with the New Jersey State Police, because the bodies were found along the highway. In the Atlanta County Prosecutor's Office, he did have some contact with people that had investigated. And again, the bodies were very decomposed, and that contributed toward their not really being able to determine whether either of the girls had been sexually assaulted. One of the women, Susan, was found face down and nude. They had both been stabbed to death, and Elizabeth was found 10 feet or so from her, fully clothed, except for her underwear, I believe. I don't know if you're familiar with the term a holdback. A holdback is a term police use. It's also called a control, when they don't tell newspapers.
Tell everybody, yeah. There you go. But still explain it. I'm sorry.
Yeah, they keep that from the papers. And several things. I just found this out about 10 years ago. Again, I've been studying this for a long time, what the control was. And the control was, or the holdback, was that one of the women, likely Susan, had been either tied to a tree with her own bra, or the bra had been tied into her hair, depending on who you ask. Also, Elizabeth. These girls came from very affluent families. You just have to know that. And Elizabeth, this is another thing I learned, not from a police authority, but from one of her very close friends. Elizabeth had been wearing very expensive charm bracelet, an heirloom given to her, as well as, I think, a diamond ring. And whoever murdered them didn't take either of those two things. So they could immediately rule out robbery as a motive, which sort of added to the intrigue. You know, what sort of person, you know, without getting into this at this moment, into the argument, the scenario of how they were pulled over, et cetera, what type of person, you know, does this, leaves that sort of signature, doesn't take anything, and then manages to get away? You have to think, you know, some deranged maniac, a serial killer. A lot of those serial killers will leave a certain marking, you know, to, they call it a signature, that characterizes the murder scene as theirs only. That's how they sort of get off, is the control, the power, and sort of teasing the authorities into saying, ha ha, it's me, now catch me.
Right, right. So, you know, I'm wondering myself, I mean, and I want to know if detectives have came up with any theories as to how one could possibly kill two girls without one just running away and being found, you know, very far away from the other, or causing some type of, you know, attention to be drawn to them.
They don't know. And that's one of the many things that make it such a strange, perfect, I want to say perfect murder, but that's what it was. When they found the car, in the days thereafter, after the bodies were found, the car was found, the bodies thereafter, you know, all the newspapers descended upon them. And a lot of the interviews with people, they started to discuss, were there any witnesses? Well, there were three boys, young men from Pennsylvania, who were in a tan Mustang. They said that they were parked about 100 yards behind the car. But what happened was they were in another town, beach town called Wildwood, and they had driven home from Wildwood and decided to sleep on the side of the parkway. Back then, you were allowed to do that. You could just pull over to the side of the road and it was safe. And you would just, they fell asleep because they were drunk and passed out and they had run out of gas. So when they woke up, they said when they pulled over and went to sleep, there was nothing. No cars. When they woke up, they saw Susan's car, or a blue convertible. They didn't know that it belonged to Susan at the time. No one was in it. They didn't hear anything. They went and ran out of gas. So they got a hitchhiked and got some gas and came back. But what had always struck me as so strange, getting back to what you were saying, how do three boys go to sleep, and how do your brain mechanisms, how are they not triggered, that sixth sense we all have? You know what I mean? When two girls are getting murdered close by, wouldn't one of them had screamed and woken them up?
Right.
That to me has just been fascinating. And I just can't come up with an answer. And obviously the police had the same type of questions. It's just a mystery to this day. Initially, they had said, well, it seems like only two people would do it. But the people I've spoken with seemed pretty consistent that one person had done this. There was also talk as to, you know, initially they said, well, it has to be a hitchhiker, because a security guard in front of the diner said that he saw two girls in a convertible at around 4:30, and some guy was seen getting into their car wearing a yellow turtleneck. And initially everyone said, it's got to be a hitchhiker. But about 4 or 5 days after the murders, a bunch of Girl Scouts had found Susan's keys near the side of the road about about 2 miles north from the murder scene, which suggests, obviously, that the murderer had pulled them over in a car, somehow gotten them into the woods, and after he killed them, taken off and thrown the keys into the side of the road. It would just be practically impossible for a hitchhiker in that area to have murdered two girls, and it would defy all common sense to think that he would hitchhike north along the parkway after murdering two girls and then take a pair of keys with his fingerprints on them and throw them on the side of the road.
Yeah. Okay. So that's my next question. Okay. So, I mean, I don't know what it looks like visually, so maybe you can tell us, like, that area, is it far away, before you could get into town or from where they left? Because I'm thinking if he has these girls out in the middle of nowhere and he's done killed them, he would have to walk back if he doesn't have a car. You know, someone would see him. You would think someone would say, hey, this guy was walking along that area at this time of day or night or whatever, if it's extremely busy area, and it seems like it was, and you need to go check him out. I mean, how in the world is that possible that someone would leave out on foot and not be seen?
That's what I say. That's exactly what I say. In fact, I go into a long dissertation at the end of the book where I envelop myriad scenarios, as to if this person had in fact killed him, how would he have gotten away, and whether he went east, west, north, or south in any direction, he would have had to have either crossed over the parkway. And let's say it was early, but it was still light out. You figure the chances are he's going to be seen if he makes a dash across the road, but maybe he waits until there's a break in traffic. Well, then he gets over to the median, which was very sparsely treed then. Then he has to go again to the southbound lanes. And although the area itself is rural, there are marshes everywhere. If he had gone south back toward Ocean City, he would have had to have swum across a creek with a fast moving channel. It's just impractical that he would have done that. Although it's rural, there were still a place called the Cove nearby, which is the nickname for sort of a teenage hangout. There is a little beach. So local kids did go back there, but it was a place only known to locals. They would go to smoke and drink and do things like that. And one thing I found that was very surprising, and it was never in the papers, because the papers had always characterized it as either a lover's lane or, you know, thick woods, which it was. But I know the owner of the property on which this happened. I befriended him a couple years ago, and he took me back and showed me exactly where this took place. And what I noticed was the existence of several paths. Two of the paths, they almost formed a horseshoe. The beginning of one, if you looked at a horseshoe, thinking in your head, the right side of the horseshoe, the left side, they going in between 31.9 and 31.8 from the road, not very visible at all. But they were there. There were no trailheads. It wasn't a park or anything like that. It just wasn't a place that you'd pull someone over and pull over a car if you were intending to murder them and take them into this area unless you knew where the beginnings of these trails were. And one thing I noticed was either the trail to the right and the trail to the left both merged at the point where the girls were killed. So that struck me as odd as well. It's like he almost, whoever did this, knew where he was taking them, which, notwithstanding, you know, Bundy's admissions and these other serial killers about this case, you know, it sort of lends itself to think, well, maybe it was a local, because only a local would have known that these paths existed. It's just hard to imagine someone not familiar with the area happening to pull over at this tiny entrance into the woods that you can't even see from the side of the road, you know, and take them there and know exactly where he was going. It's just hard to believe.
Yeah. That's very shocking. Wow. Okay. What did they say about motives? I mean, did they come up with any reason? You said it was no robbery involved or just senseless, really. I mean, did they take anything? And what did they find inside the car? Did they find anything inside the car?
They found nothing inside the car. The only thing that was there didn't appear when Trooper Sturr looked at it. There was nothing indicating that, you know, the car was full of gas. There was no skid marks. there was Susan's straw purse, which was inside the car. However, Elizabeth's leather black purse was found near her body in the woods. So you're like, why is her purse there and the other one there? And then you start getting into the whole scenario of you know, one was taken in one at a time. But no, they were never able to discern a motive because these were two girls with, again, very sheltered girls, delightful girls from very affluent families who just didn't have any enemies. The police interviewed what started out as 100 men, it grew to about 2,500 people, and no one had anything bad to say about them. There were no enemies, no issues with ex-boyfriends. They interviewed the people who had stayed at the 9th Street boarding house, and no one there really, I think a couple of guys went out with them for a beer or so, but they said they're very innocent. No one who was interviewed saw them really talking with any unsavory types, whom in retrospect would appear to be viable suspects.
This is baffling. It really is. Right. I see why you wanted to take this on. And then the admission with Ted making the comments, which I want to talk about here in just a moment. But okay, so let's talk about the boys on the Parkway. Now that is amazing. Yeah. All right. Did you get a chance to talk to them or anything?
Believe it or not, 2 years ago about, I was fishing with my friends down the Jersey Shore, and it was fish weren't biting, which means we go and we drink. So we're at a bar and I got a text from a person saying, I understand that you're interested in this investigation. And it was a source. The source had sent me the names of the three boys because that's what I had asked. And again, this is an open investigation, so I wasn't getting anything. I'm still not getting anything from the present state police because there's in New Jersey, you're obviously entitled to public information, but there's an open investigation exception to what's called the Open Public Records Act. So I wasn't able to get any sort of information from them. So,
okay. All right. Now do you know how long, okay, maybe you said it and I want you to refresh my memory. I'm sorry if I missed that, but how long was their car there? Well, wait a minute. You said that the boys were there first and then their car was there, right?
Yeah. They got there first. And thank you for refreshing, my memory. I maybe went off on a tangent there.
Okay.
You brought me back. Thank you. So those three boys, I did find their names, attempted to contact all three of them, and none of them returned my calls, which I thought was rather odd. But look, you know, I'm not in their position. I mean, it was strange. They all lived now in their 70s in the very same area where they lived back then, which is a tiny town in Pennsylvania. But no, none of them returned my calls, but they all passed lie detector tests. And in fact, one of them returned all the way from Pennsylvania to the Absecon, New Jersey barracks, which was the state police barracks where the investigation was headquartered. With the guy went down with his father who owned a gas station and spent several hours with the police. So they were never considered suspects. But again, I really wanted to talk to them just to say, how do you not hear anything? Doesn't a girl scream? Doesn't anyone scream when you're 50 yards away from them?
Right. How is that possible?
I don't know.
I don't see how that's possible. I really don't. You know, I mean, to me, they would be natural suspects because they were there.
Right.
And no one saw anybody walking away from the area, and the girls were.
Not only that, but how does a person decides to do this? Well, does he develop this MO? Does he plot this out? Does he, you know, decide beforehand? Does he spot them? Whatever. But you would think when he sees another car there, he wouldn't decide to pull them over at that point.
That's right. Right. Well,
right?
Why? It doesn't make sense. Okay. We got a car that's a few feet, you know, from us. I don't know how far away were the boys.
About, I say, you know, in the yards, about, I want to say 50 to 100 yards. Don't quote me. Near enough that if two people were getting killed, you would hear the screams.
That's right. You would definitely hear it. Why would you take that chance? And that is just not logical to me.
Well, you know,
I mean,
it's not logical. It's not logical. But here's another, again, another theory, which I explore deeply in the Garden State Parkway murders, is that you have all these bars. My theory is whoever did this was up all night. They weren't asleep. I don't think a person trying to get into that mindset. I don't know if you've ever been up all night, you know, back in the old days, partying, whatever the case may be, working. Yeah, we all have. And it's not a great feeling. You feel, you know, when you, it's 6 a.m. and 7 a.m. and you see people going to work or going to class and you're like, you feel a little dirty and you're just in a strange mindset. Now imagine a person who has a severe, you know, mental disturbance, has been drinking all night or doing drugs. Okay. So obviously whoever did that was, it was in another realm entirely. And I think the sleeplessness combined with, again, a mental imbalance sort of lended itself to that particular set of circumstances in which these murders occurred, if that makes sense. So, again, I think it lends itself to the fact you see these three boys. Why do you pull them out? Well, he wasn't in his right mind anyway, but he did it in such a stealthy manner that, again, you start to think, well, he had to. How did he carry this out? If he was drunk and on LSD or whatever it was, how did he so quietly manage to do this in front of these guys, take them into the woods, kill them, and then drive off?
Right.
Right?
Right.
It's just bizarre.
It is very bizarre. Okay, so let's throw Ted in this equation. Okay, so before Ted actually made the comments about being in Ocean City, were these murders thought to be committed by any other serial killer that frequented that area?
Serial killers? No. Well, they actually didn't. There was a number of people. Let me take it back to the investigation itself. So about five, this leads to the question you're asking. So about 5 days after the murders, these two girls are in a clothing store in Philadelphia, and some kid walks in and starts talking to them and says, I was there when this down in Ocean City, when these girls got killed. He's wearing a yellow shirt. The store clerk overhears him talking and remembers reading in the paper of the security guard at the Summers Point Diner saying that he saw two girls pick up a guy in a yellow shirt. So he calls the Philadelphia Police Department and they find this guy and they bring him in. And I don't know if you know anything about the Philadelphia Police Department back in the 60s and 70s, had not the greatest reputation. They would really, they would beat up suspects pretty badly. They were known for taking telephone books and putting them on either side of the head and the ears and beating them that way because it wouldn't show any bruising. So that notwithstanding, they brought this kid in. His name was Mark Thomas. And they questioned him, and he gave what the newspapers characterize as quote-unquote fuzzy answers to a lie detector test. So upon reading these lie detector test results, they called the New Jersey State Police in. They sent a couple of detectives George Dix and Mr. Patterson in there, and they, you know, grill this guy all night long. And the strange thing about this kid is at the end of the night, he's free to leave, and he agrees willingly to accompany them back to New Jersey. So you have to think, does this kid really do anything? Because what kid who had killed two girls decides, oh, I'll go back to the police with the police and ask some more questions.
Right.
So ultimately, he lawyers up. His parents find out he's in New Jersey. They release him and move on to other suspects. The next person of interest is a guy named Ronnie Walden, who is not a serial killer. I'm wrong. He's a drifter. One of the women who I interviewed at length called the state police because she had met him in Fort Lauderdale a couple of weeks earlier while on spring break, said, I saw this guy And I know it was him because the girls who got killed had blonde hair. I have blonde hair. He was obsessing over my hair. So they call this girl in and say, well, was this guy wearing any jewelry that you're talking about? And she says, no. And they kept asking about jewelry. She's thinking chains and whatnot. And they said, well, he was wearing a watch. She said he was. And they showed her a picture of the watch. It was a diver's watch. And that's what they found at the crime scene. This hasn't been the newspapers yet. This was held back as well. A diver's watch and Susan's glasses. So upon learning where this person's identity, that the police did an APB. And this is where it gets weird. So they find him. He's wanted on auto theft charges at the time. He left New Jersey about a week after the murders. He had actually driven up from Fort Lauderdale and stayed in Atlantic City for a few days and met this girl's friend. They had a relationship, and he left right after the murders. So he's out in Colorado on auto theft charges. The New Jersey State Police fly out there. And as they're going there, on the day of their arrival, I guess a couple hours beforehand, this guy tries to hang himself in his cell. I interviewed the jailer. Now, here's where it gets crazy. It's the Garfield County jail, which is in Glenwood Springs jail, which is in Garfield County, Colorado. He winds up trying to hang himself in the very same cell in this tiny jail of like 60 cells where Ted Bundy escaped through the ceiling fixture in 1977 and escaped and went on to murder the four co-eds down at Florida State.
No way.
Yes.
That is, you got to be kidding me.
I'm 100%. I know. I'm 100% serious. I mean, the coincidence.
What an unbelievable coincidence that is.
So, but then he tries to kill himself beforehand. They give him the lie detector test. And the jailer told me, I remember it because he said he had this, you know, this neck brace. Then he said, it wasn't a joke. This guy was, you know, just about dead when they got him and revived, but he wound up passing the lie detector test. Ronnie goes off and he's always a suspect. And this person that I interviewed told me that the police, she kept her notes after all these years, and the police told her that they were 99 and 44 100% certain that he was the guy who did it and that they had found a half a fingerprint of his on the car. And she remembered that term because back in the 60s, that's what Ivory Soap commercial used to describe the Ivory Soap bar. It's 99 and 44 100% pure. So, but despite all that, he's free, and Ronnie gets free, and he goes on to a life of crime after a grifter, et cetera, auto theft, what have you. And then it's the case just went cold from thereafter. And then you had Ted Bundy talking about it. And in 1983, so I'm even taking it back a few years, you've got 1969, the murders, you have Ronnie Walden, 1983, about 6 years before Bundy was executed, a guy named Gerald Stano, who was a serial killer in Florida, killed 33 women, and was executed down there. He was living right next to Bundy on death row. Well, in 1982, he had actually admitted to the murders of Susan Davis and Elizabeth Perry. But the police, when they flew down there to interview him, didn't believe what he was telling them. What I discovered, which was stunning to me, was that this Mark Thomas lived 1 mile from Gerald Stano in 1969 and was friends with Gerald's younger brother, Roger. I talked to detectives with the Payne Township Police Department. I talked to detectives with the Pennsylvania State Police. All of them said that the New Jersey State Police, who, you know, aren't talking about the case to me because it's an exception to, you know, it's an open investigation. They said that Mark was friends with Roger. Now, Mark being the 18-year-old, okay, was friends with Roger, and that they had been in Ocean City, and that the New Jersey State Police had interviewed Roger. Now, I ask you this, what are the chances? You know, wouldn't you think that if they had interviewed Roger, they also would have interviewed Gerald, the serial killer? Both were juvenile delinquents. So to me, it lends itself, and maybe this guy was telling the truth, this being Gerald. He was in the area, and back before he moved to Florida, he was in Philadelphia in 69. There's substance to what he said. And what the public doesn't know, and what I, again, discovered through my investigation, and all of this, by the way, is in my book, The Garden State Parkway Murders, is that, you know, that Gerald may have been down at the Jersey Shore when this happened, notwithstanding the fact that the police didn't believe his confession. But we know if what the Pennsylvania police authorities had told me, we know is true, that his younger brother, Roger, who died in 2016, was in fact down there. So, and by the way, Mark went on to a whole other career of crime. He was in the Ku Klux Klan and all that stuff, but I don't think he killed them. And many of these girls, I don't think he had anything to do with it. I think it was all a notoriety game with him, and he enjoyed being the center of attention. What I do believe is that, you know, as certain as I am that he didn't do it, I'm sort of equally certain that he knows something that he's not sharing for whatever reasons. That's just my, you know, that's just me sort of theorizing, you know, what does he know? We don't know.
Yeah.
But I sort of think if I was to conjecture, what does he know? I would think that, well, maybe he knows. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Maybe he knows, who was down there and who did it. Because when you were 16 years old, you know, you think about it, you know, you remember everything about that. You remember who your friends were when you were 16. I don't know a single person who doesn't remember who they were with when they were 16 years old.
Yeah.
You know, you had a very small circle of friends at that point in your life. Well, not when you're 18, you go away to college and your network just expands. You sort of have a limited number of people with whom you fraternize when you're that age. At least I did.
Oh, I did too.
So, and you know who they were. I mean,
yeah, people, yeah.
If someone says the name to you today, who'd you hang? Oh, I know. Absolutely. So
let me ask you something about Gerald. Did he give any, first of all, is he still alive?
No, he was executed. Again, he lived next to Ted Bundy, who also, I mean, the coincidences that thread through this case are just beyond bizarre. But no, he was executed, I think, in 1998 for the murder of several women down in Florida. He was a Daytona Beach guy. He would murder prostitutes, but he also murdered several young college girls. Or at least was accused of doing so. He always said up until the day he died that his confessions were coerced. But the way these girls were found, it was something I didn't add earlier, was that the clothing was piled neatly alongside them, and they were buried in sticks and leaves. And Gerald was always concealed the bodies with sticks and leaves and piled the clothes neatly nearby. So the crime scene matched up with his methodology of killing as well, which is another thing that could tie him to the murders of Susan Davis and Elizabeth Perry.
Well, I was going to ask you that, you know, did he kill them in the same way he had killed other people? What about using a knife? Was he doing that as well?
Yes, he had used a knife. There's one, I was able to get some documentation from a Florida agency. I won't say it on air, but I did get his entire file on CD-ROM and was able to see some of the crime scene photos. And I think one or two of the cases he did bind his victims. He stabbed them as well. So the MOs were very, very similar. The only thing is Gerald wasn't exactly, Ronnie was a ladies man. You could envision how Ronnie would coerce through whatever means of persuasion necessary to get two girls to pull over to the side of the road. Gerald was not that sort. Gerald was not what you would call a ladies man. He wasn't a very attractive guy. He was short. And in fact, he had always said, you know, he actually said, I think his thing was, I hate a bitchy chick. He really had an anger toward women. And that's why, you know, he was acting out a lot of the time, just his hate for women and doing these things. But it's difficult to see him being able to coerce two women over to the side of the road, at least under any sort of pretense, given who he was.
Right. Just unbelievable. Really. Right. You've did an amazing job on the book, and I do suggest everyone pick that up. Before we go, Christian, can you please tell my listeners where they can find more information about you or anything else you're working on?
Sure. The Wild Blue Press website, if you looked up, just Google Christian Barth, Wild Blue Press, or the Garden State Parkway Murders, that'll bring up my biography on there. You can listen to a few of the other podcasts I've done. Obviously, this one will be posted there soon, at Twitter, at Christian E. Barth. And I'm on Facebook, the regular means, look me up on Amazon. The book is for sale. Again, it's the Garden State Parkway Murders, a cold case mystery. And it's also for sale at a terrific independent bookstore in Ocean City on Asbury Avenue called Sun Rose Words and Music. Nancy Miller and Roz Lifshin are the owners. Nancy has been just phenomenally supported, but she was around back then as a girl and she remembered this case. So she's just been nothing but kind and supportive in trying to bring attention and community involvement into trying to get at least a grassroots movement and get this thing solved. So that's where you could buy it.
That's great. Are you working on any other murder mysteries or anything like that?
I'm investigating a few. I've partnered up with a friend of mine who is actually from Belfast, in Northern Ireland, and he's a producer. So we're presently trying to pitch this as a series of some sort, with several of the streaming channels as we speak. So that's where it is right now.
Very good. Make sure you keep us in the loop about that, and I'll let my listeners know. Christian, many blessings to you. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you. And I've had a great time. Thank you so much. I'm very, very grateful for you having me on your show.
Well, what an interesting interview. I've really enjoyed that, and I want to thank my special guest, Christian Barth, for joining me again. His book is called The Garden State Parkway Murders, and it is available on Amazon as well as wildbluepress.com. To find out more about our guest and all others, please visit our website at mysteriousradio.com. And I want to give special thanks to our co-creator and executive producer, Kim Kyle, who brought this show to you today. And working hard behind the scenes, our team of four, I want to thank them as well. Follow us on social media and share the show with others that may like the subjects that we cover. I am your host, K-Town, and you're listening to Mysterious Radio.